The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
How does a young actress survive an extremely traumatic, difficult childhood, sexist and abusive behavior in Hollywood, and much more, and then go on to write a memoir about it? Actress Rose McGowan will be here to talk about her new book, Brave. What exactly is autofiction, and how does it differ from a novel? Novelist Katie Kitamura will be here to talk about her review of Tom Melquist's new novel, In Every Moment We Are Still Alive. Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Joining us now is actress and activist Rose McGowan, and also author of a new memoir called Brave. Rose, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Pamela, for having me.
So I've got to ask, you are on many platforms now. You're publicly speaking. You have a show on TV right now. You're on social media. Why did you decide to write a book?
It was always going to happen. My accountant for the last 20 years has been telling me to write a book with almost the answer to every email I send her when I'm, someday I'll write a book of my adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Those have been quite splendid. Behind the scenes, I've lived quite a big life that people didn't know about. I did many different things. The book for me really started, I imagine, on the plane coming to America when I guess I was speaking and unloaded to the woman next to me, my seatmate, and I was flying across the world with just a tag around my neck. And
an unaccompanied minor.
Yeah. And she said, "You need to write a book." And I said, "You don't know the half of it."
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember that conversation. So I always knew. So I saved things in my mind for posterity from a young age. You know, not unlike saving your costumes from a movie you've done. You know, I saved images. And like I say in the book, I found a brownie, or my father found a brownie camera, which is an old camera from 50s, 60s. And it was taken away pretty quickly, but I loved looking at things through that square. And I just pretended I had that over my eyes all the time. And I think that's how I can remember so much detail.
I was going to ask, because there's a lot of detail,
yeah,
especially
I'm
from your early years.
I'm a very detail-oriented person. Like, I have really impeccable long-range memory. I have a short-term, not so bueno. But apparently they've done studies and it's that you tend to be one or the other. So I'll remember
or
this
neither.
In 5 years. Or neither. Gosh. You know what everybody, I'm sure, is terrified of Alzheimer's, but I wonder if you do, in fact, go back to your childhood, what if it's not a good one? Do you have to relive that? That seems dreadfully unfair.
Well, a lot of your childhood was really tough, really difficult. I mean, was it hard to sort of reimmerse yourself in that?
Completely. This book, 50% of it, or 60%, it's tough going, but not in a Debbie Downer way, just in a we're climbing some mountains way, I think, you know? And then there's the structure around it, which is talking about why the mountains exist in the first place and what they do to maybe your brain because those mountains exist. Yes, I was born into a cult called the Children of God, but it was just where we lived, you know, it was what we did. And the thing about this book that was so hard to write, it's just, you know, and I'm sure you've had other memoirs on here that have said it, you resurrect ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all around you, right? And some of them are malevolent ghosts, for sure. But then you have to all of a sudden exit where you've been writing, and there's your boyfriend standing there, and you try to put on a happy girlfriend face so he doesn't break up with you and think you're too insane, when really all you want to do is bend over and scream.
But it's also about revisiting, like, an earlier version of yourself, right? And was that hard to kind of inhabit where you were at that time and try to remember what it was like for you?
I wasn't trying to remember. I always knew I was chronicling for the future, just like on movie sets, gathering data.
Had you kept a diary when you were little, growing up?
No. I mean, a visual. Mm-hmm. What I would do actually later was take Polaroids, and I had an art book, and I take Polaroids, tape them in, and then write around it. And that was those. I have a great diary from 1998. 1998, I believe, and 1999. And it's such a time capsule. It's all these Polaroids and all of what I felt around it. I think for me, you know, as I'm a director and photographer, I visually relate more to emotion than I do verbally, because English is my third language.
So Italian was your first?
Cult.
Tell us about what it was like growing up in the Children of God cult.
A minefield, really, you know. And as I say in my book, there was a lot of beauty because I was in the Italian countryside, and it was stunning. And
if you're going to be in a cult, best to be in one in the Italian countryside.
Let's be in Tuscany. If you're going to be, exactly. So the Phoenixes, that family, you know, River and the rest of his siblings, they grew up in the Venezuelan chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a bit like, I think, growing up in the Medici court, what mm-hmm. I imagine it to be. But there was an underlying tension to everything. And I was essentially, you know, my father would say, if you ever, you know, see anything, say anything kind of thing, you know, roughly. And so I felt sometimes like a bit of a little informant, gathering data. But I was sure when I turned 14, the world would change and I would be listened to. And that was the thing. There was no soft place to land. And that's been a hallmark for me. So I created it myself in my head.
As part of getting your story down on paper here, sort of a way to get people to listen to you?
No, I don't. That's the thing, actually. I worked it out so they don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't have a choice in that I'm crisscrossing many platforms, because I realized that I didn't think I could effectively conduct my social reengineering project, which is what this is. This, to me, is a public works project. Mm-hmm. No one's paying me. I'm paying, you know, and I love it when people are like, you're profiting. Did you think I wrote this book in 2 months, you idiots? No, this was a slog, and words matter. At some points, I swear I felt like I had every letter in the world from every language just plopped in my head, and I couldn't get them out of my fingers fast enough. And it is, you know, it's a puzzle. And to connect ideas and thoughts to your own life, to use like really intense, I suppose, stories or, you know, reality to make the broader point. And only a few so far, and not even the New York Times, to be honest, have understood the broader points. And I think it's because of programming culturally that seems to be people, oh, this is for teenage girls. What? No, I want the 85-year-olds, and I can, because mm-hmm. that's who I talk to. And the media, they struggle right now because there's been obviously a paid-off concerted smear campaign for 20 years of me, and by the media, because a lot of them are paid to. And now all of a sudden they have to rejigger that thought, and they don't know quite what to do. So I knew that the article had to come out. The articles mm-hmm. had to come out before the book.
Because you were working on the book before.
I've been working on this book for 3 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, and longer. I wrote some of the chapters 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
What was it like, right? What's the writing process like for you, especially like compared with acting process?
Yes. Well, I don't really like sitting very much, you see, and that was a problem. So I started taking flights wherever I would try to pick places that weren't too expensive to go that had at least 7 to 8 hours in air, 6 to 7, 8 hours. So I could be in that, I hate that sitting position where your arms are tucked into your side and you feel like a T-Rex. It doesn't feel free. And I don't know if it's because I grew up in Italy, but speaking with my hands, that's how I express myself more mm-hmm. than speaking. And it was hard. But on planes, you're penned in that position, I realized. So that's where I forced myself. And I would read. I tried to read a lot of, I write from 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. every morning. That's my good for you. That me, I wrote at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I took, those flights were always at night. Nighttime, I feel like between 3 and 5 a.m., it feels like all the neurons are firing so quickly. And during the day, it's taking care of business. It's not creative, particularly for me during the day. At night, that's when the world stills. And I've always preferred to live at night. Most of my movies, for whatever reason, they were shot at night. And so I lived in that world that wasn't a real world and then didn't integrate with society normally. You know, that's kind of what I posit in this, which is, what if someone who didn't grow up like you
mm-hmm.
and was not formed like you might have a perspective on the collective you that might be valid, it might be worth listening to, because just like anybody, like the man coming from North Korea today who escaped, right? He was at the State of the Union. It's like he has information about North Korea. I have information about cults.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the books that shaped you and informed you, not only as a person overall, but specifically in the writing of the book. And I want to start with, because you start with your book with Frances Farmer, which of course was turned into a movie, but was also a book before. And I'm curious if you'd read that book.
No, I had not read that book.
Were there books that inspired you in terms of other people's memoirs? Or?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the other half of this book is actually an album.
Mm-hmm.
And I incorporate some of the lyrics into Brave because they go hand in hand. And just like with music, which I've only listened to really classical music or hip-hop in the last 3 years because I didn't want any influence.
Mm-hmm.
When I would tell people I'm writing a memoir, they're like, oh, you have to read this book. No, that's that person's book.
Right.
That's their mind. That's their path. The hardest thing for me was, because I'm a real non-linear thinker, was trying to format things in a somewhat linear fashion. That was the excruciating part for me. What's formed me, what saved me, it's always been words. The earliest book I remember reading story was The Telltale Heart. I was very young, and I don't know how I got my hands on it, but they had a lot
Not
of—
Not a children's story.
No, but I don't believe in children's stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hansel and Gretel is horrible. I read that later. I read that when I was 14. I was like, this is traumatic.
Yes.
Bambi is traumatic. Let's be real. I think kids, we handle a lot. You remember that? We handle a lot when we're children. And a lot, and we're really underestimated. And for me, words are my solace in other worlds. I didn't like where I was particularly. I didn't like the people talking to me, but I could leave and I could travel and I could escape just like so many do through the written word and people's service to the world by writing. You know, I collect first editions.
What do you have?
Oh, gosh. I have a Ray Bradbury Fahrenheit 451 signed. I have Dashiell Hammett first edition signed. I've been hunting for a signed Raymond Chandler for years, but I don't think that's ever going to happen because he didn't. And probably my favorite is Slaughterhouse-5 with a personalized inscription by Kurt Vonnegut. I think it was a couple months before he died. And he drew a caricature of himself. Mm-hmm. And he said, I don't know you, but God bless you. And for me, growing up, like I'd say 13-year-old self loved the stories of Eva Luna. 14-year-old self, The Count of Monte Cristo, the unabridged version, which I reread about once every 2 years. I've reread Love in the Time of Cholera every year annually since I was 14.
Wait, what appeals to you about The Count of Monte Cristo?
I mean, I think there's some obvious parallels, I guess, in some ways. Having your life stolen.
Yeah.
And having it done through ego and malevolence for no good reason other
unjust
than
accusation.
That. Unjust accusation. Yeah. I had always been told I was bad, you see, growing up. You're bad. You're bad. God can see the dirt under your nails. You're bad. And I would get so bored. I was like, yeah, I know. I got it. I'm bad. Thanks. And while I blocked most of it out with a real concerted effort, I would, if I had it, you know, I remember very clearly, like, when I was 14 coming down, you know, to get breakfast, but being mad at myself because I forgot to armor up, which is what I would normally do psychologically before I came down the stairs. I would put this kind of, like, hard exoskeleton on around me that I would imaginary, and that would protect me from the things that were going to come my way. But sometimes you forget. You're tired. You go downstairs for cereal, and you forget to armor up. So that's when the things— they stick.
You were, from a very early age, sort of asked to, or not asked, maybe forced to perform. You had to sing religious songs or cult songs, you know, for money as a young child. And then we're moving so constantly. You went from living in Italy to living in Oregon, right, to living in Seattle and sort of constantly changing caregivers.
Quite a few places in between, but it was just too much for the book.
Oh, wow. And then adopting— you know, different sort of personas and trying to find yourself and then going into acting, which seems like a natural extension of that. I mean,
but accidentally.
Yeah. How accidentally?
Well, I never wanted to be. I just knew I was going to be.
And this, in a way, is the opposite, right? Because it's about really finding yourself and finding your own voice. And I'm curious if the writing process helped in that.
It helped me articulate it.
Mm-hmm.
I find I, in interviews in general, everything, I almost always prefer to have the written question because I, you know, you can think and the words, you can choose more carefully. You know, sometimes when I speak very quickly and do say the wrong things. We all do. And, you know, my words are parsed apart, perhaps more than yours. Maybe not, but I have a feeling they are. And sometimes you say the wrong thing. But also you think, just like when you leave someone, you're like, oh, I should have said that. But I didn't have that with Brave, you see. I said what I wanted to say, and I formed it the way I wanted to form it. And I think the people, if they focus on the micro of it, mm-hmm. which are the stories, you know, certainly of Hollywood and things like that, or even younger, the written word really helped me connect, I believe, the inside of me to the outside of me.
To take that particular story, personal
story. It's my narrative. This right. is mine. And this is why specifically I worked with the New York Times on getting these articles out and Ronan and all these things. But I did not want to be in those stories because I had a book coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I want to step on other women? That made no sense to me. Mm-hmm. They have their time. They have not gotten to speak. I know what's coming up for me. And I'd been working on it, you know, and I helped Asia and Annabella, Asia Argento, coached her through the process of getting her to talk. And she got herself to talk, but we, you know, it was a joint effort. Same with Annabella Sciorra. And I knew that if I was involved, it would, just like if I was on the red carpet and all of a sudden Jennifer Lawrence stood in, who would get more flashbulbs, right? That's how it goes. I didn't want to do that to those women. They haven't had a voice.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I'd had a lot longer to deal, you know, the stress writing this book. I cannot honestly believe I pulled this off considering what was going on in the background.
So now the book is out. When you think about sort of what your hope is, you've met some authors that you admire. Presumably you met Vonnegut.
I never did.
Oh, you never did? How'd you get that signed edition?
A friend of a friend. I got me. I was reading another Vonnegut book, and I read Slaughterhouse-Five for the first time when I was 11, and parsed it apart, and you know, went back at it because I had to connect ideas as I grew, and that's why I go back to a lot of the books that I loved when I was younger, because there's, you know, when you have an instinct towards something.
Mm-hmm.
And then later it becomes clear why you had that instinct, but you can only do that with time, a lot of time, you know? So
what do you think that instinct was? What drew you to Vonnegut, for example?
irreverence and puncturing, you know, subverting the dominant paradigm, really.
Mm-hmm.
When I came to America, I remember seeing that bumper sticker, and I was trying to work out what, one, the language was, but two, what it meant. So I came up for a long time in my head, it was subvert the dominant paradigm. I was like, paradigm? Paradigm. And I thought, that's a good idea. So I will. It'll take me a long time to do it, but I'm going to do that. So I think I did.
I want to end on, not on your story for a moment, but to going back to your life as a reader, since you are flying around, you're doing
yes.
a book tour here. What are you reading right now? What have you read recently that's great?
The Weight of Ink. And I'm sure you've had this, but I've—
And the author is?
Rachel Kadish.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan Dominus, the New York Times, who wrote, I worked with her here and she worked with me and did a great profile. As it turns out, Rachel Kadish is a friend of hers. And Sue Dominus wanted to connect us. And I, you know, my book is called Brave.
Mm-hmm. You were scared to. Yeah,
Not yet. Not yet. Her words are so good.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few times I actually gasped out loud reading, and not because she's showing off, but just her mastery of language. And it was so powerful and visceral, and the language. She loves language, you can tell. She loves these words. She loves wrestling with them and playing with them, and that I so appreciate. And the story itself, you know, is incredible and obviously rooted in history, but it's about a 16-year-old who becomes a scribe for a blind rabbi and you know, essentially uses his name to converse with the greatest thinkers of her day about spirituality. This is in 1640. So
mm-hmm.
it goes between times, but her use of language. And I haven't been able to read a book since because I open them and I think, oh, not yet. It's like kind of, you know, when I read The Count of Monte Cristo for the first time, you think, oh. And I don't know if you do this, but sometimes I get so attached to characters, I have to mourn them for a while.
You want to keep them with you?
They are with me until they can go away enough till I can meet somebody else.
Rose, thank you so much for being here.
And the last line of Brave, I know you can just by being brave. And that's what we can all do. Thank you.
Thanks, Rose.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
My name is Thomas Gibbons-Neff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Katie Kitamura joins us now. She is not only a novelist, her most recent book is A Separation, but also an excellent critic. And this week she reviews a new novel by Tom Malmquist called In Every Moment We Are Still Alive on our cover. Katie, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. It's an arresting title, first of all, and obviously a very interesting story. Tell us about what the book is.
Yeah, I mean, the novel opens in a moment of medical crisis. The book's narrator, who is a Swedish writer called Tom, is in the hospital with his wife, Karen, who is 33 weeks pregnant and is undergoing a complete physical collapse. And in the opening pages of the novel, she is diagnosed with leukemia and she dies, and her child, before that, their child is born by a C-section.
Wow.
So the kind of novel follows the fallout of the final days of his wife's life and the early days of his daughter's life, and then the kind of tidal wave of grief that overwhelms him.
And this is the story of his own life as well.
As I understand it, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's categorized as fiction. I imagine it's quite important for him that it's a novel rather than a memoir. I mean, one of the interesting things about the book is that it's written in present tense.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me seemed like a very deliberate choice on his part to kind of define his project against the kind of conventions of a grief memoir. So it's explicitly a book that's not being recollected. It's kind of unfolding before us.
What's it like to read?
It's intense. It's, you know, when I was first sent the book, I had some hesitations. I think the material is very tricky. It can become sentimental. It can become cliched. I think you can make the intensity of what happened to these characters feel weightless in a way. And he does the exact opposite. He doesn't talk about his emotions very much. He really draws the reader into the experience. And it's very sustained. I think the first 100 pages or so are just in the hospital, and he almost doesn't go outside of that setting.
So she's hospitalized and diagnosed at that time,
yes,
of hospitalization,
yes,
and then dies.
And then they choose to have this C-section to, mm-hmm, save the child, so to speak, and then she dies shortly after that.
Wow. In your review and the sound of the sort of tone of it reminded me, and it probably has nothing in common with it, but of another book, which is a memoir, but similarly kind of catastrophically tragic circumstances, which was Sonali Dhirmaniagala's book Wave, just that kind of unimaginable circumstance and what sounds to me like a kind of similar immediacy and absence of sentimentality.
And I think also a kind of defiance as well. I mean, I think it's this refusal to believe in this narrative of recovery, which I think is so dominant in our culture, and this idea that there is in some way something redemptive about this experience, because I think of course, the title does indicate some kind of new sensitivity to the world, but I think searching for the silver lining to the cloud of your partner passing is not the project that he is interested in.
What do you think he is interested in?
It was interesting. I mean, my father died of cancer, which is a completely different kind of relationship. But I do remember when he died, I remember thinking there's nothing I can do for him except to witness his death as closely as possible. And to some extent, I think that's part of what he is doing. He's kind of bearing witness in a utterly unsentimental way to the life and the death of his partner. And I think he's not that interested in his own journey in a curious way. I put that in quotation marks, but I don't think he's that interested in uncovering what the landscape of his emotions was during that period. But I think he is just trying to commit to paper the extremity of the emotions that he felt during that period.
But then that's interesting because then that effort at documentation, you would sort of think that he would then pursue memoir. And I'm curious why.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think right now is an interesting time to think about the line between fiction and nonfiction, which is obviously being eroded. But it was interesting that both Malmquist and also Knausgård in his My Struggle, I think it's both quite important to them that it's a piece of fiction. And I'm wondering if that's because when you're writing about your own life, if categorizing it as a novel allows you a kind of latitude to look for and render a truth that you feel is essential, a reality that you feel is essential, but is maybe in some way different to a factual truth or reality.
Right.
If that makes sense.
And every memoir now, of course, has that caveat that, of course, this is, you know, some of it is recreated, that not all of it necessarily happened. It makes you really do question that idea of, well, in some way, these are necessarily created things.
Yes. I think My Struggle is interesting because you have to take that as a given because so much of the book has to do with memory. And this is a little bit different because it does not have to do with memory. I mean, one of the powerful things about the novel is that the events that are taking place in it don't come to you through the filter of memory or hindsight. So they have an immediacy.
Yeah.
And so I think part of the claim of the novel is in fact that it's not being recreated by the narrator, Tom.
For listeners who are not familiar with this book but have perhaps heard of My Struggle and the fact that it is multiple very long volumes long, should know that this is actually not a long book. It's fairly taut, right?
It's under 300 pages. And he does so much that's technically difficult in this book. And I think it's extraordinary that he's able to do that over the length of nearly 300 pages, but I think it would be almost impossible to do over 3,000 pages.
What was technically difficult? Like, as a novelist, what did you observe that?
Well, I think writing at that length in present tense is very difficult. I think writing at that length I think it's quite tempting in a scene often to kind of rely on the emotional reaction of a character, for example, to give it a certain depth, to make a scene work. I mean, I see it kind of happening all the time. And he really resists that. At no point does he rely on saying, I felt this, or I was devastated, or anything like this in order to give a scene depth. He's really relying simply on his descriptive powers. And because it's always in present tense, he's never able to go out and say, looking back, I would realize this was the moment, you know, whatever it is.
Right, right.
So it's actually incredibly, I think, very difficult technically, and it requires a lot of restraint because there are just things that you can't signal to the reader in the way that you might be able to if it was past tense, if you were relying more clearly on a kind of retrospective analysis of your feelings.
And also, for the reader, I imagine the challenge is sort of not to kind of exhaust the reader in a way, because you can't allow the reader to sort of step away or.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think he plays with that boundary between exhaustion and boredom, which is I think somewhat counterintuitively the experience that many of us have in a hospital is that it's somewhere between the waiting and trying to understand this medical language that is kind of being thrown at you. It's a sort of combination of feeling both overwhelmed, bored.
And then guilty about the boredom.
And guilty about the boredom. It's a very, and I think he really takes you into that because there are moments of very long technical description that are exhausting and that are, I think boring is going too far, but they certainly kind of push you against that edge. And that's part of what makes it feel very, I think, immediately familiar to anybody who's been in a similar situation. I think part of what he's doing is also making us feel the duration of what it means to wait.
You open your review with a brief discussion of autofiction. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those terms that I think probably most readers have heard maybe, but don't really know what it means. What is that, autofiction?
I mean, it's a phrase that I think was first coined in the 70s in France. And it's a relatively established tradition there, and I think in Europe as well, generally speaking, where you have autobiographical novels, I suppose. But I mean, it covers a very, very wide rubric of fiction. I mean, I think Knausgård would fall into that category. Marguerite Duras, a lot of her work would fall into that category. Annie Ernaux as well. And I think it's interesting because it feels like there's a real explosion of that right now in English language fiction at the moment, which is very exciting for me as a reader to see. I don't know if Malmquist would place himself in that category or not, but certainly it's clear he's playing with some of the conventions of writing a piece of fiction in which there is a character that is named, has the same name as the writer, has the same biographical details. And I think it's provoked some interesting debate about the purpose of fiction, I think. I think some people have wondered if there's something now tedious about the kind of mechanics of fiction, you know, of plot, of inventing character. But what's so interesting to me is that some of the kind of great practitioners of autofiction nonetheless are adamant about characterizing their work as fiction. And I think fiction retains some incredible things. I think the truth often has a structure of a fiction rather than the documentary reality around us. And I think that's certainly something that Malmquist is playing with in this novel.
There's something in your review that really struck me, and I'm going to read from your review here. You say, the reader is dropped into this abyss with little guidance. There's almost no hierarchy of detail or information because Tom doesn't know what's significant and what isn't. Everything is important, not only because the action is unspooling in real time, but because in the first moments after his daughter's birth and the final moments of his partner's life, the most mundane detail is precious. Quote, her eyes, eyebrows, eyelashes, nose, and that little indentation in her skin by her right nostril, that's the only thing that's still the same, but it's enough. It's Karen. Tell me a little bit more about what you meant in that passage.
That was one of those moments where I really saw how he was using something that was, in some ways, a technical decision to because he's telling the story in present tense and he doesn't know, you know, this is the key medical detail. So he's just telling us everything. And it's very effective because as a reader, you also don't have, you're not able to pick out the narrative. Mm-hmm. It's being constructed as it happens. It's not being told retroactively. But then that seemed to me like a key example of how, for example, he takes something like that and then he makes it have incredible emotional resonance because just as he doesn't know, you know, which medical detail is important, it also has this, on an emotional level, he looks at his wife and, or his partner rather, sorry, and everything is important because this may be the last time that he sees her alive. So there's that kind of sensitivity which has to do with the fact that he's completely overwhelmed in the midst of this medical crisis, but it also has to do with the heightened emotionality of being on the brink of losing the person you love.
How did the book affect you emotionally reading it?
I was really very devastated by it. And I have to admit, I wasn't expecting to be on some level. I think I thought when I saw the, you know, the general synopsis and the presentation of the book, I thought, you know, I've read a book like this before. I know this narrative. And it completely took me by surprise. And I think it was a restraint, really, that I found very, very moving. I mentioned in the review, there's a moment when he can't tell his partner's, Karen's parents, that she's dead. And so he can't find the words. He literally can't find the words. So he uses this kind of quite obscure medical language that the doctor has just used with him. And that restraint, the inability to express his grief, that I found incredibly powerful because in my experience, that is very much what grieving feels like. I think when you have the language to express it, to put it down on paper, then you've already recovered to some extent. And this felt to me like I was in the midst of a living, breathing creature in some way, and that creature is grief.
And now you know why we love having Katie review for us and why this book is on our cover. Katie, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Katie Kitamura is a novelist. Her most recent book is A Separation, which came out last year, to rave reviews. And this week, she reviews on our cover a new novel by Tom Malmquist, In Every Moment We Are Still Alive.
Alexandra Alter joins us now. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
All right, so you have some news from the awards world, even though it's not quite one of our award seasons yet.
Yes, some breaking news from the literary awards world. The National Book Foundation announced this week that they are adding a category, which is a very big deal because they have only four categories: fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and young people's literature. And it required a unanimous vote from their entire board to add a category. They're very focused, and they mm-hmm. they don't want to dilute the power of the prize. But the category that they're adding is a very exciting one, and I think it's one where there's a lot of great literature being written, but perhaps not celebrated as much as it should be, and that's why they're adding it. And it's a prize for translation, mm-hmm. works in translation. They'll be honoring both the author and the translator, and there are some restrictions on it. It has to be published in the United States in the year that they are looking at, although it can be a translation of an older work,
mm-hmm.
even a retranslation.
Oh, interesting.
But the author must be living. So you don't typically get, you know, that many retranslations of living authors. You get a new Homer or a new Tolstoy, something like that. This really opens up what has always been a distinctly American literary award to the entire, you know, world, although not English-speaking authors.
Yeah, I was going to say, according to my geographic calculation, someone is being left out.
Yes. No, it's kind of funny because I'm sure you remember the whole backlash over the Booker Prize expanding its geographic reach when they decided to open the prize up to any book published in English in Britain. So that would include Americans, and Americans have indeed been winning quite a few Bookers lately. We had George Saunders win and Paul Beatty. So I wonder if British authors feel like, well, they should have a shot at the National Book Award. Mm-hmm. Come on, you guys are taking our Booker. And in fact, they are not going to be included in this prize.
And there's already the Mann International Booker Prize, which they award for works in translation.
Yes. And in fact, they actually specified it just in recent years that it would go to books in translation. Previously, it would include English language books from authors living abroad. So they actually recalibrated it to specifically focus on translation. And there's the Penn Translation Prize, and there's a few other prizes that look at works in translation. But I think it, you know, there is this perception in the industry that translated books don't sell that well, even though there have been major breakout authors, Elena Ferrante and others, Stieg Larsson, of course. But, you know, I think that perception is not quite accurate. There are these exceptions to the rule. But I do think that publishers maybe feel like it's a riskier proposition to publish a book in translation. Often the author can't come to do interviews. The cost of translation has to be factored in, and mm-hmm. they worry that the books won't resonate with American readers. So I think by dangling a prize out in front of people, it might serve as an inducement for publishers to say, well, maybe we could hit it out of the park and get a National Book Award, and it would really shed a light on, you know, a lot of these books that are being translated and published here. And of course, then you have the long list and the short list. So it will, you know, a greater pool of authors will be recognized.
And what's the thought on like leaving the UK and the Commonwealth?
I asked Lisa Lucas, who's the executive director of the National Book Foundation, that question. And she said that while, you know, she loves a lot of those English language authors, they get enough attention already, is her feeling, that what they were really trying to do was highlight works that aren't getting recognized as much and read as much. And, you know, Zadie Smith is wonderful, and a lot of the incredible authors coming out of Africa who are writing in English are fantastic, but their books, perhaps because they're written in English, there's not that sense of a barrier for American readers, and people are picking them up more. That was her feeling. So they really do want to also, I think, recognize the art of translation itself, which is a really sort of difficult, you know, thing to do, particularly mm-hmm. with literature. And I thought it was interesting as well that the prize will be open to both works of fiction and nonfiction.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah.
And will the judges be translators?
They haven't actually selected the judges yet. They're going to start doing that soon. And she's certainly open to the board is certainly open to having some translators on there, and publishers and scholars. And I think it would be very interesting to have a translator on there because they're in the best position to sort of judge the accuracy and sort of the skill with which it's done.
Yeah, I'm in awe of translators, so it's exciting to see them being recognized
exactly.
for another award. All right, thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
So for those of you who like to read books and aspire to read more books, in addition to listening to us yammer on about books, we have a new thing here at the New York Times. It is a special literary calendar called Book Your Calendar. If you Google Book Your Calendar, you will get there, or you can go onto the New York Times book page at nytimes.com/books, and you will see it there. And if you click on the link there, it will sync up to either your Google Calendar or your phone calendar, your mobile device. And then when you go on your calendar for any particular day to see what your meetings are and all of your exciting appointments, you will also find out what is going on in the literary world. So not an overwhelming amount of information. We don't want to drown you in all of the latest books news, but we look at kind of a highly curated list of author anniversaries, hashtag holidays related to literature and books in general, new books, major new book releases, that kind of thing. So for example, say it were February 1st, Thursday, you go onto your calendar to see what you have to do that day. You will also find out that it is Muriel Sparks' 100th birthday. And not only do we let you know that, of course, Ms. Sparks died in 2006, but were she alive, it would be her 100th birthday. Not only do you find that out, but you can also click to read the original New York Times review of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. You would also know that February 1st is World Read Aloud Day. So if this sounds of interest, if you want to be reminded when Myra Breckinridge turns 50 or when the latest book by Zadie Smith is being published, then go online. Either Google Book Your Calendar, you will get there, or go to the New York Times website at nytimes.com/books, and you will find us. I hope you enjoy. So this week we introduced something new and very exciting, we hope. It's called Critical Mass, and for the first time ever, all three of the New York Times book critics are here to talk about what they have reviewed this week, sometimes to talk about other things. Joining us now, we have Dwight Garner, Parle Segal, and Jen Salai. Hi, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
All right, let's start with the books. And let's start with Dwight, because you reviewed two massive books this week. Tell us about what you wrote.
Yeah, you know, both Martin Amis and Zadie Smith, two very different, basically British writers from different generations, have new books out of essays. And I thought it'd be a good chance to sort of look at, you know, what the state of the essay is right now as regards to England, and also just to read these two terrific writers. I mean, I could not be happier as a reader to sit down by books of criticism from Zadie Smith and Martin Amis. I mean, they're just two of my favorite writers. And, you know, I have a professional interest in criticism. So this, for me, was just, I can't believe I got paid to exist last week reading it.
So the books are Feel Free is the Zadie Smith title. I have to give the full title of Martin Amis's book because the subtitle is so sort of weirdly unexpected in its way, in that it includes John Travolta. The books are Feel Free, Essays by Zadie Smith, and The Rub of Time, Bellow, Nabokov, Hitchens, Travolta, Trump, Essays and Reportage, 1994 to 2017. And since I brought up Travolta, let me ask specifically about that piece. What does he have to say about John Travolta?
Well, this piece is about 15 or 20 years old, the Travolta piece, and it's excellent. He uses that famous F. Scott Fitzgerald quote about how there are no second acts in American lives. And then Martin Amis says, you know, was he drunk when he wrote that? Because look at John Travolta. And he wrote about the fact that Travolta's career, after beginning so beautifully with Saturday Night Fever and Urban Cowboy and Grease, he went into eclipse for a long time and was kind of a joke. And so Amis is just sort of riffing on what happened to turn this career around. And there's a funny postscript at the end of the piece where Amis says, well, basically, you know, his career is in eclipse again. But it's a great sort of slice of time, this essay. And Travolta comes off as kind of an interesting and oddly wise character. I recommend the essay.
Martin Amis is also, I think, probably mine, I think, of a lot of people's favorite critic practitioner. And it was really amazing. So his previous book of collected criticism was The War Against Cliché, which won the National Book Critics Award for Criticism, and is probably my favorite book of criticism, collected criticism. And it was really interesting, I think, for me. I just read The Rub of Time, I think, 2 days ago after reading Dwight's review. And it's really interesting to see him revisit the people that he wrote about in the first volume for me. So he wrote about, I mean, like, he loves his Larkin, he loves his Bellow, he loves his Nightfall, he has his gods. And it's interesting to see how he's changing a little bit. Right. So like Nabokov, who he would like defend to the death and say, like, the work matters. Don't read Lolita looking for these, you know, suspicions of pedophilia and all this stuff. But in this book, he does something really interesting where he says that he's looking at, I think he was reviewing the origin of Laura, and he does this thing where he's just like, look, I don't want to go into the life or anything like that, but at a certain point, Nabokov stopped treating these nymphettes like they were human. And that's a really interesting, you can see him change. Or even with Larkin, he says that, you know, let's not lose the beauty of Larkin's work by saying, oh, he was a misogynist or he was a racist or all of this stuff. But in this book, again, like a slight modulation happens. He goes, he's still a great artist, but I'm perplexed by the man. So I think that for me, it was interesting to see him return to these familiar themes and change in public. You know, and then the great topic of Zadie Smith's last book of collected criticism was Changing My Mind. So I think for me, it's very interesting to see these critics continue to change their minds about people that they love.
And also, I'm curious to hear what both of you think about, and Jen, weigh in as well, about them as novelists versus essayists and critics.
I've always loved Zadie Smith's essays, I think more than her novels. I loved NW, but for me, like, that's the place where I just find she can do this way of thinking through things and of being messy and of contradicting herself and of changing her mind, as she says. And I also just love the way that she brings in her life in these ways. So you see, like, the context, you know, all of this thinking about race and Brexit and whatever else she's writing about is happening in the context of her life in this moment, this winter, squeezing her kid into a snowsuit, you know, soothing a child, walking to a lecture. She just marries analysis and thought with the life in a way that I find really beautiful. So yeah, I love her essays.
I'm a fan of both, although I will say in terms of the novels that I really loved NW as well. And I really like Swing Time, which I know is a controversial proposition. I do agree with Parle that in the essays, she just sort of brings this sensibility and this freedom. I mean, I think that is really hard to find in essays that also presents itself in such a way that's also very sort of lucid and clear. It's this perfect balance.
Right. It's both kind of loose and...
Yes. Yet. I mean, I feel like I'm in awe when I read a lot of the pieces.
Yeah, I think that word is totally... It's freedom. It's you do free. Feel that. And yes. I feel like when I read her, she also expands my own sense of possibilities of writing.
Totally.
You know?
Totally.
And then I try to do it and I do it badly.
Oh, come on.
But when she does it, you feel like, oh, yeah, this is how to do criticism.
Yeah, and she really also... There's a way in which everything... I mean, even though I think she's a great stylist and, you know, she obviously cares about the sentences, there's a certain... honesty and directness, which I don't know how she does it. I mean, it is one of those things where I just sort of read the essays and I'm just like, wow, okay.
Right. They feel kind of unfiltered and yet very polished.
Yes. Yeah.
And to you, they feel intimate, you know? Whereas Amos, I'm 50-50. Love the novels. I'm crazy about the novels and I'm crazy about the criticism. I still feel like he's very similar to me in both places.
And I love his memoir experience.
Oh, you love the memoir.
So, yeah. Yeah. Dwight, what about you in terms of their fiction versus their essays?
I had read every piece in both books already because that's how much I like both of their writing. I look for their bylines. Zadie Smith, you know, became the book critic for Harper's Magazine a couple years ago. She only lasted 6 months, but it got my hopes up because I miss the days when some of the great writers, I mean, I'm thinking of John Updike in particular, wrote criticism quite regularly. Mm-hmm. And Zadie Smith is so good at it that I sort of was hoping that she would keep going. And I'm waiting for other younger writers. I hope more of them decide. I mean, I know a number of them do it, but even do it more regularly.
And are you a fan of her fiction as well? Have you read her novels?
I am. I've not read Swing Time, but I've read everything else. I'm a terrific fan.
It's interesting that no one mentions White Teeth, which is considered to be her, you know, obviously it was her breakout debut.
I do think it's an impressive book, but, you know, she was, what, 23 or something? I mean, I do think that what we were talking about in terms of the essays, that you sense sort of a real sort of directness and honesty in them. There's something about that book, and I think she herself has said it since publishing it, that she was trying to imitate everyone. You know, she was trying to imitate Amos. She was trying to imitate the people that she really looked up to. And I think that there's a way in which it's super impressive, but it doesn't sort of resonate with the same, I don't know.
I agree.
There's something with the later books that even Swing Time, which I don't think reaches the same level as NW, but there's just something about it that just feels much more confident.
Yeah, I think you're really getting to the heart of like something that I've been trying to think through. Her novels, and I love the novels, but you know, she really does, each one is so different, and in part because she wants to keep setting different challenges for herself. But her essays, she sounds like herself. there just seems to be a certain kind of confidence that I feel when I'm reading it. That sometimes in the novels, I feel like she's trying a form. She's setting a interesting challenge for herself.
So it's more self-conscious.
Yeah, totally. You know, and then that's fine. And like N.W. might be her most mannered, self-conscious book. And it's my favorite one of her books. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's not a slight against her.
All right. We brought up debuts. You reviewed a debut this week, right, Pearl?
Yeah, I did. I reviewed a book by, and if I'm bungling your name, I'm so sorry, Therese Marie Milo, who is a first-time writer. She wrote a book called Heartberries. And I think I was just going through stacks of books, seeing what's coming out these couple of weeks. And, you know, there were some big books, and I just flipped through this one. And I'm sure as this happens to all of you guys, like, just certain sentences, I was just stuck to me. It was like a nettle. Like, I just, and I was, like, planning on reviewing something else, but I kept thinking about this book, And so then I decided to review it, and I'm very glad I did. It's really unusual. Dustin Kurtz is a bookseller I like, and he has a good way of describing it. He says it's as if Maggie Nelson grew up like Mary Carr and then had Mary Gateskill-like adventures. Mm-hmm. So you're getting...
That's amazing.
Yeah, isn't that, doesn't it? I mean, yeah. Sell the book. I mean, so it's about this woman who grew up on a Indian reservation out in British Columbia called Seabird Band and just grew up with a lot of a family riddled by addiction and abuse and sort of, you know, grew up in foster care, started writing. And it's just, I'm making it sound so grim, and it is grim, but it's also incredibly funny because she's writing against stereotypes of Native Americans. She's writing against, you know, her own family's mythologies. And the actual occasion for this book is she's institutionalized and she's writing these series of letters to a man who's abandoned her. So it's full of yearning and insults and
well, her descriptions of the man that you quoted in the review were incredible.
It's so good. She's like, my friend thinks that, you know, my husband can't communicate love. I think he's impotent. You know, she's funny and strange. And she's just, I also think that she's doing this thing where she's trying to think through how to tell a sad story. And one of the things she says is that, you know, in white culture, forgiveness means letting something go. And she goes, well, in my culture, you don't let it go. Forgiveness means, you know, you feel what you feel and then you have some kind of ritual and then you pass through the emotion. And the book itself feels like a kind of ritual, a new way of thinking about how do we think about suffering we've endured and caused other people, for sure. And what does it mean to come out the other side of it? So it feels like she's kind of inventing new forms. It was really exciting to read.
All right, I'm going to make a terrible segue here. And before we talk about Jen's review this week, speaking of mispronouncing names and speaking of other cultures, I want to make a correction.
Oh, no. Where is this going to go?
No. It goes to a good place because it gets us to accuracy. Someone named Salma Barada wrote to me and said very nice things about our podcast before correcting me. So I'm now going to correct it on air. Last week, I said that The Perfect Nanny, that Leila Slimani was the first Moroccan to win the Prix Goncourt, but she is not. She is the first Moroccan woman to win the Prix Goncourt. The previous winner was Tahar Ben-Jalloud. So let the record be corrected. Salma, thank you for writing and letting us know. And now, on to you, Jen.
Okay, so this week I reviewed a book called Rise and Kill First by Ronan Bergman, who's an investigative journalist based in Israel. And it's essentially about Israel's secret targeted assassination program. And it's a 750-page book, so I was particularly interested in the way in which Bergman handled the sort of the enormous ethical issues, as well as the historical context in terms of how this program came about. But I should also say, because I wasn't able to get into it a lot in the review, that for people who are interested in books having to do with espionage, spycraft, I mean, he's deeply sourced. He has a lot of details about that stuff, just in terms of how this stuff actually happens or takes place, and often actually how it doesn't work out. And the book is really an impressive accomplishment in terms of reporting. You know, it's also interesting because Israel has a censor. So if you write about this stuff, essentially it's subject to a military censor, which is also a larger, interesting question because Israel officially neither confirms nor denies the existence of this program, but the publication of the book implies that there's some sort of tacit admission of something.
Yeah.
And the quotes in this book are just incredible, which is also kind of fascinating. I mean, he talks to a lot of people who are very candid, people who worked at extremely high levels of intelligence, who have really serious second thoughts about stuff that they participated in, but also people who say, well, you know, yes, there are moral problems, but, you know, we did what we had to do because we had no choice.
I heard him speak about the book this week, and he said that there are two big questions that he wanted to address. You know, one is sort of what are the legal and moral boundaries here with this kind of assassination? And the second is it effective?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and essentially, I mean, the sort of larger point that I took from the book is that on a tactical level, you could say in many instances it was effective in the sense that after certain assassinations, the number of terrorist attacks, you could measure that they went down. Because if you take out somebody who is a high-level operative and they're unable to actually help plan attacks, then that will have an effect, at least immediately. Mm-hmm. But he also points out that because Israel became so good at it, essentially, that what ended up happening is that it was seen as a way to deal with all sorts of issues that probably needed much more sort of more of a political approach, more of a larger strategic approach of, okay, well, what should the relationship with the Palestinians be? How should we deal with this? I mean, these are larger, deeper issues that require more of a vision. And I think the sort of overwhelming sense that you get from the book is, well, look at where we are right now. I mean, it's still a difficult situation. And I think also having Netanyahu in power, that's also something that he sort of suggests is essentially that Israel society right now is sort of going into a conservative direction. And what does that mean?
When you're reading a book like this,
yeah.
And this is a question that I think that people would have, like, what does it mean to review a book like this? Like, what are you thinking about as you review something? Because, like, the story is amazing, his reporting is incredible, but, like, how are you, like, critically assessing a book like this?
Well, you know, I will admit that this was a book also that I sort of decided fairly recently, like at the last minute, that I would do. And it was partly because I started reading it. And the thing that I was impressed with is basically right from the get-go, he makes it very clear that he's going to be dealing with bigger moral implications, which to me anyways, that's really interesting. I mean, obviously there's other readers who are interested in different stuff. And I'm sure if you gave this book to another reviewer, they would pull at a different strand of it. But when you read something so long and it feels long, which this book did not, that's when you sort of begin to think, okay, did it need to be this book? Whereas this book is long, doesn't feel long, and you realize that there's probably another 1,000 pages that probably could have been written about it. The writing is good. It's lucid. It's clear. But I'm really dealing, at least with this subject, more on the level of what kind of reporting he did, how does he really put it together, how does he bring in historical context, how does he push against some of his sources, which is also an interesting thing, you know, because obviously he's deeply sourced. Presumably he doesn't want to burn certain sources, but at the same time, he is exposing certain things that, and certain quotes where you sort of listen, you read it, and you think, my God, somebody actually said that.
I have a funny behind-the-scenes story to share, speaking of those sources, which is that this book began in 2010, actually, as a story originally for GQ and then for the New York Times Magazine. And the magazine excerpted the book in a piece that ran a couple of weeks ago. And the writer, Ronan Bergman, who is Israeli and, as you said, is an excellent reporter, had done all of his work, he said that he got these frantic calls from some of his sources during the process when the New York Times Magazine was fact-checking the excerpt.
He
said that you know, his sources called him, and I can't imitate an Israeli accent. It would be much funnier if I could, but that they called and they said, you know, Ronan, what is going on? These fact-checkers, they're calling me. I've been interrogated by Shin Bet, and I've endured, you know, harsh, you know, testimony by the government and this and that, but I have never ever been questioned like by anyone until these fact checkers like this, which I thought. But it's true. I mean, yeah. Some of the great parts of your review were just these quotes. Like, you have to give this phone quote.
Oh, well, so he, and this was actually in the notes, so he conducted, I think, 1,000 interviews over the past 7.5 years. And at one point, he got in touch with a Mossad historian, like, an, you know, somebody who works for the Mossad as a historian. And essentially, I don't remember the exact wording, but the person said, "I will never talk to you. Even if everybody else talks to you, I will never talk to you. And I despise whoever it was who gave you my phone number, and I despise you." This was apparently sent by text message, which seems even better in some way.
Yes. Preserved now in print in the book. All right, let's end on that very cheering, kind note. Jen, Dwight, Pearl, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Inside the New York Times Book Review is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.